On March 9th and 10th, Cleveland Right to Life hosted the third annual Bringing America Back to Life Symposium. Through prayer, action, the vote, and education, we labor to uphold the sanctity of human life and lead our nation back to a culture of life. We hope you will be inspired and motivated as you listen to our guest speakers define and defend the complex issues that make up the pro-life movement.
Austin Roos has headed the Catholic Family of Human Rights Institute since the summer of 1997. He appears on national television networks regularly discussing UN and Catholic issues. Roos has been published in numerous national periodicals, is a columnist for thecatholicthing.org, and edits CFAM's Friday Facts. He is a knight in the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, a knight in the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre, and a founding member of the Diplomatic Society of St. Gabriel. He holds undergraduate degrees from the University of Missouri and an honorary doctorate from the Franciscan University of Steubenville. Please sit back and enjoy Austin Roos's informative and fascinating one-of-a-kind presentation as he discusses the San Jose articles. This program is free of sponsor breaks or advertisements. At the conclusion of the presentation, we have included the question and answer segment with questions presented by our 2012 symposium MC, the renowned Star Parco, who is the founder and president of CURE, the Center for Urban Renewal and Education, a non-profit think tank which promotes market-based public policy to fight poverty.
Today you will hear about a fight you may be only vaguely aware of. You may have never heard about the fight you will hear described today. Wherever, whatever your level of awareness and knowledge, this fight will affect your life and the lives of your children and their children. It is a fight about abortion, to be sure, but it is about more than that. And rather than talk about the religious, ethical, moral, and scientific questions concerning this important issue, I intend to explore certain larger theories that now animate this and other issues on the international scene. I will certainly talk about abortion, but today I will look at certain legal theories and theories of international relations that are driving this and other social policy issues. Today we will look at international law, both treaty obligations and customary international law, and how they are being used to advance an international right to abortion. We will also look at how pro-life policymakers and lawyers are pushing back through the San Jose articles and other avenues. We will take a particular look at the San Jose articles, however. The fight takes place in a number of venues: the United Nations, the European institutions, national courts and parliaments around the world, but it is also taking place in law schools where these theories are being taught. Right now, somewhere in the world, someone is being taught not only incorrect theories of international law, but dangerous theories of international law. But I want to begin with definitions. You're going to hear some of these words throughout this talk, and I just want to touch briefly on the definitions. And also keep in mind that whole libraries have been written about these topics, so each of these are a thumbnail sketch. International law is the understandings, agreements, and practices that govern the interaction between and among sovereign states. Traditionally, and the key phrase there is between and among sovereign states. It doesn't touch on the individual, though new treaties today do, and this is one of the dangerous changes. Traditionally, this was derived either from custom or from treaties, or a combination of both. I emphasize this has to do with the relationship between and among states. This had nothing or next to nothing to do with the individual. It should also be noted, traditionally there was no means of judicial enforcement of obligations under international law, and this has changed in recent years a little bit. Even so, without voluntary compliance in order to enforce treaty obligations, states must resort to diplomatic, economic, and even military pressure. Moreover, it has been and is now generally up to states to determine their own treaty obligations. This is important. As we sign treaties, nations get to interpret their own, largely get to interpret their own treaty obligations. Of the two parts of international law, a treaty is a written and ratified agreement between two governments or among a group of governments. Treaties can comprise a myriad of purposes: trade, telecommunications, criminal issues, defense, humanitarian issues, human rights, and many others. It should also be noted that even here in hard law treaties, governments are largely free to determine their own obligations under the treaties. All of this will become important as we talk about an international right to abortion or an international right to life. The second part of international law is what is called customary international law. Customary international law requires two parts. First, consistent state practice over time. That is to say, universal state practice. Something can become a part of international law even though it's not a treaty. You do it through custom. And customary international law requires universal state practice with the understanding that there is a legal obligation to do so. This is important because it's one of the key arguments of the other side about an international right to abortion. For those who are taking CLE, what is required is what is called opinio juris et necessitatis, or any opinio juris for short, which refers to a belief by states that the practice is legally required. Number four, UN resolutions play a big part in this. They are non-binding instruments negotiated by member states of the UN. They are aspirational documents that have no force in law. Such documents include, among dozens of others, the outcome documents of the Cairo Conference on Population and Development and the Program for Action of the Beijing Women's Conference, which are widely known. The fifth definition is the CEDAW Treaty. CEDAW refers to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination. It is an international treaty that's been ratified by every country in the world, with the exception of the United States and Somalia. Six, UN treaty monitoring bodies. They play a role in this because they determine the implementation of hard law treaties like CEDAW. They are non-judicial bodies who make comments, and their comments are not binding on states' parties. But there's a trick in there that I'll get to in a minute. I'm going to be talking about NGOs, non-governmental organizations, which are non-profit groups that perform many kinds of functions. Some sling bags of rice in poor countries. Others make policy at the United Nations. In fact, any group of people, there's nothing magical about the word NGO. It doesn't mean that you're connected to the UN at all. Cleveland Right to Life is an NGO. Any group sitting around a dining room table working on an issue at the school board is an NGO. There's nothing magical about that phrase. It simply means a group that's not connected to the government. It's a group of civil society. It's a group of citizens. And then lastly, national sovereignty is the right of all peoples to govern themselves in accordance with their own institutions and by their own consent. National sovereignty is the right of all peoples to govern themselves in accordance with their own institutions and by their own consent. This is vitally important, because some people, even high-level people here in the United States, think that national sovereignty means something entirely different. The case is being made today by various actors in various national and international bodies that abortion is a universal human right that governments are legally bound to uphold. They base this assertion on two arguments. First, customary international law, and second, treaty obligations. Making this case are human rights lawyers connected to powerful NGOs, law professors and their friends on the bench around the world, also by international bureaucrats at the United Nations, the European institutions such as the European Parliament. In the year 2000, President George Bush reinstituted what has become known as Mexico City policy. Mexico City policy, first instituted under President Reagan, says that taxpayer money cannot go to groups overseas that promote or perform abortions. Upon reinstitution of this policy in the year 2000, George Bush was promptly sued in federal court by a powerful NGO called the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, now known as the Center for Reproductive Rights. Among other things, the group asserted that their own First Amendment rights were being violated because their allies overseas would be denied federal funding. I hope that sounds as specious to you as it is to me. Secondly, they asserted that this restriction by the Bush administration violated international law, since a right to abortion had become customary international law. So let's review the definition of customary international law. It is an international legal norm that is universally practiced with the understanding of legal obligation, absent any treaty obligation. That is the point of customary international law. There is no treaty obligation, that is to say a hard law treaty obligation, but universal state practice has made the thing legally binding. This is a very high bar. And because it is, very few things actually rise to its level. And for something to rise to this level takes an awfully long time. In 2004, the Supreme Court had occasion to study the notion of customary international law. In Sosa v. Alvarez McCain, plaintiffs pursued a case under something called the Alien Tort Statute, a law enacted in 1789 that enables foreigners to initiate tort actions in the American judicial system for violations of what is called the Law of Nations, which it also means customary international law. It's an old, old law in the United States that allows foreigners to bring court cases here in the United States against companies doing business overseas for violations of international law. It's actually a hot topic right now. The court was forced at that time to confront the question of what was the content of customary international law when the Alien Tort Statute was enacted more than 200 years ago. Justice Souter, who is not our friend, wrote, quote, "It was only a narrow set of violations of the Law of Nations that admitted a judicial remedy and at the same time threatened serious consequences in international affairs that were on the minds of the many men who drafted both the Constitution and the earliest laws of the United States in the late 1780s. Only three were cited at that time: violation of safe conduct with regard to the trading of ambassadors, and the related infringement of the rights of ambassadors, and lastly, piracy. So let me underscore this. All through the mists of time, and up until 1789, there were only three questions of customary international law. Only three. So let's return to the claim of the Center for Reproductive Rights, that the repetitious use of phrase, now this is their case. The Center for Reproductive Rights said that the repetitious use of the phrase reproductive health in non-binding UN resolutions has established a customary international law that abortion is universally legal. For their assertion to be true, a few things have to fall into line. First, reproductive health has to be defined as being synonymous with or including abortion. In fact, reproductive health has only ever been defined as including abortion in a single, non-binding UN resolution, which is the Cairo Program for Action. Reproductive health is used in one binding treaty, but is not defined as including abortion, and is not put forward as a right, but only as a category of non-discrimination, meaning where reproductive health is legal for men, it has to be legal for women. In this particular case, it was a treaty on the disabled. Where reproductive health is legal, it has to be legal for the disabled. So it's not an absolute right to whatever reproductive health is, it's that everything has to be equal. Second, the bar that they must pass is that there must be universal state practice on abortion. And one thing we know for absolute certainty from looking at abortion laws across the world is that there is little in law that is less settled than those related to abortion. There is absolutely nothing like universal state practice. You go from countries where it is abortion on demand like our own to countries where it's absolutely illegal and everything in between. This is not a settled issue, far from it. There is no universal state practice. Third, states must recognize there is a legal obligation to legalize abortion, and in the case of legalized abortion, very clearly there is no such understanding anywhere. Well, that's not quite true, and I'll get to that in a second. It should be also understood that customary international law cannot happen without consent. It cannot happen by accident. When governments are negotiating non-binding documents, such as those cited by this Center for Reproductive Rights, they do so with the understanding that these documents were merely aspirations and do not therefore bind them. International law is not falling off of logs. It cannot happen accidentally. Even the atmosphere of a negotiation of a non-binding document is vastly different than the atmosphere of a binding negotiation. In a binding negotiation, governments send in their first team. In a non-binding negotiation, they send in the clowns. I mean, I've been there. Treaties are deadly serious because governments know they will be bound by the results if they choose to eventually ratify it. Based on how customary international law develops, very clearly it cannot be applied in the case of legalized abortion. The Center for Reproductive Rights suit was thrown out of federal court. The First Amendment claims were rejected specifically, and the rest was tossed out for their lack of standing to bring the case in the first place. It is interesting to note that the judge who made these decisions is now on the Supreme Court, Judge Sotomayor of New York. So she was right. Two final points on customary international law. I was sitting at my desk one day, and a Federal Express package was delivered that contained secret internal documents from the Center for Reproductive Rights. They were sent to me anonymously. I get a lot of stuff like that, and sometimes it takes me a while to open them. And I eventually opened this one, and man, it was the internal documents of a 5-year review, a strategic planning session of the Center for Reproductive Rights. It was everything that they said and everything that they believed. It was really quite astounding. There were the minutes and memos from this strategic planning session, and I don't know who sent them to me, but they were and are very important in our understanding of the thinking and intentions of this most powerful nonprofit law firm. In the documents written after their suit against the Bush administration, they admit that customary international law does not apply to abortion. I didn't know this talk came with sound effects. This, however, did not. This understanding of theirs did not prevent them from spinning their tail in federal court. As a side note, we immediately reported in our weekly Friday Facts that we had these documents and what they said. Within a few hours, one of their lawyers knocked on my door and demanded the documents and threatened a lawsuit against us. We promptly gave them to Chris Smith, who put them in the Federal Record. But dang it, I've been trying to get those ladies to sue me for years, because I would just make a ton of money in direct mail. But they will not sue me. We do expect ongoing claims of customary international law to continue. The second line of attack on the assertion of a universal right to abortion is one that has borne the most fruit. These are arguments based on what abortion proponents assert are treaty obligations. So there's customary international law based on state practice under an understanding of legal obligation, and then there are hard law treaties. Remember, treaties were written agreements that legally bind the signatories. Treaties can be bilateral, that is between two countries, multilateral among many countries. Since the end of the Second World War, and because of the creation of the UN and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we have seen the creation of dozens of human rights treaties, all of them multilateral, and at this point, most of them signed by most of the countries in the world, with the exception of the United States. You know, God bless the United States. Even under democratic administrations, even under democratic senates, we do not ratify these treaties. Remember also that it is the states themselves that determine their own obligations under such treaties. There is no supranational body that can impose a meaning on any particular treaty. The UN cannot do it. UN committees cannot do it. The International Court of Justice, a part of the UN, can review a dispute between states on treaty obligations, but only if the court is given such jurisdiction by the treaty itself or if the countries place themselves before that body. Governments themselves are free to coerce compliance with a signed treaty. This can take the shape of economic, diplomatic, and in some cases, military action. Arguments that treaties now demand liberalization of abortion laws come from the notion that certain UN treaties demand it. These assertions are routinely made by what are called UN treaty monitoring bodies and echoed by human rights lawyers. And such assertions have found some traction with judges in at least two countries, Colombia and Mexico. Recall that UN treaty monitoring bodies are independent groups of experts elected by states' parties to the treaty. They're charged with meeting with states' parties, asking questions, and issuing reports. The members of the treaty bodies come largely from the academic world and also from the world of advocacy NGOs. Many of the members of such committees come from NGOs that campaign outright for abortion. These committees do not have the authority to impose their view on any member states. These committees only have the authority to make suggestions that governments are totally free to ignore. These committees do not have the authority to reinterpret the treaties they are charged with monitoring, but they do so all the time. Even so, UN treaty monitoring bodies routinely tell governments they must change their laws on abortion. The worst offender is the committee that monitors CEDAW, the the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. I love to emphasize all forms of discrimination. This committee has directed more than 90 countries to change their laws on abortion. 90 countries. Other similar committees have done the same thing. The Human Rights Committee, for instance, now interprets the right to life as the right to abortion. Here's the central thing you must know about these arguments. Not a single UN treaty mentions abortion. These documents are utterly and totally silent on abortion. All human rights treaties are silent on reproductive health and reproductive rights, with the single exception of reproductive health as mentioned in a treaty on people with disabilities. But I'll emphasize, even there, it is not mentioned as a right, but as a category of non-discrimination. So you see, these UN human rights treaty monitoring bodies have gone far beyond their mandate in telling committees what to do, beyond the four walls of the treaty. But they have gone even further and formally rewritten the meaning of these treaties. They have taken it upon themselves to reinterpret the treaties. In effect, they have rewritten hard law treaties and then tried to impose the new treaty language on sovereign states. Let's take a moment and reflect on just how non-democratic that is. How not just non-democratic, but anti-democratic. Sovereign states spend months and even years negotiating these treaties that will bind them in law if ratified. This is among the most serious work of any sovereign state. Yet here we see a group of largely unknown, completely independent academics and activists rewriting hard law treaties and in trying to impose their private views on sovereign states. It is an axiom for political self-determination to have any real meaning. Citizens must have the ability to affect policy outcomes through lobbying or elections. I ask Joe Biden, who favors the CEDAW treaty, to name a single member of the CEDAW committee without looking. I would give Joe Biden $1,000 for every member of the CEDAW treaty monitoring body that he could name without looking. Yet these are the people that he wants us to report to every 2 years. The thing about these treaty monitoring folks and the reason that they're anti-democratic is that we cannot really touch them. I can go to these meetings and watch them work. I can talk to them, but we can't vote them out. If they make a bad decision, how do we punish them politically? That is at the heart of the democratic proposition. This chasm is among the biggest democratic deficits in the world. The leader in this movement to rewrite UN treaties is the CEDAW committee, which monitors compliance of CEDAW. Remember, CEDAW is silent on abortion, silent even on reproductive health. But you see that they have not only told governments they have to change their laws on abortion, they rewrote the treaty to say that abortion is now a universally recognized human right. And they've done this through what they call General Recommendation 24. Has the body of states parties to the treaty agreed to this? Has the body of states parties to the treaty agreed to this rewriting of the treaty? They have not. CEDAW is not the only treaty monitoring body that has done this sleight of hand. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights is silent on abortion, silent on reproductive health, a phrase that had not even been invented by the mid-60s when this treaty was negotiated. But the treaty does mention a right to life. Does the treaty monitoring body interpret this as protecting the unborn child from abortion? No. The committee now interprets the right to life as the right to abortion. A woman who cannot get an abortion has her life threatened, so goes the reasoning. This committee now tells governments they have a treaty obligation to liberalize their laws on abortion. And it's not like some governments have not pushed back. Some have. Ireland has been repeatedly badgered by this committee to change their laws on abortion. They have even put abortion up to national votes and have told the committee this. The committee keeps badgering them. Not long ago, the committee was after Pakistan, and the representative of Pakistan flatly told the committee that abortion was murder. And most governments simply ignore these orders from committees. Where the committees find the most traction for the directives, however, is with those I hope you will do battle with all the time, human rights lawyers and activists, who then take these phony cases into national courts and parliaments and tell the unsuspecting policymakers and judges that a new international legal norm has been established at the United Nations. A few years ago, the High Court of Colombia succumbed to this pressure and changed their laws on abortion. In their decision, they repeated the orders of the CEDAW committee. A few years ago, the Supreme Judicial Body of Mexico upheld the Mexico City's liberal abortion policy, and two of the justices cited CEDAW as justification. I'll just remind you, CEDAW is silent on abortion, silent on reproductive health. The only reason that they can do this is that a committee of academics in Geneva and New York has reinterpreted the committee to include abortion, though they don't have the power to do so. So what about the United States? Are we so big and strong that we can resist such directives from our betters at the UN? Well, we have lawyers, we have liberal lawyers and liberal judges here too, don't we? There are two temptations among American conservatives. One is that the UN is so big and strong that it is about to take over the world, that they're about to march down Main Street and take Granny's gun. The other temptation is that we are so big and strong that we have nothing to fear from the United Nations. I am proud to say that our elected officials from both parties have long resisted joining these UN treaties. We have never joined CEDAW, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, or the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, or most of the others. But we do have liberal lawyers, and most importantly, liberal judges and justices. There is a case called Lawrence v. Texas, in which the Supreme Court ruled that homosexual sodomy is a constitutionally protected right. In that decision, the majority cited rulings by the European Court of Human Rights. And I'm not sure if they're in the Constitution, but I suspect they're not. They cited evolving international norms, which is a way of mentioning customary international law. But there's certainly no custom on this issue. Almost 100 countries penalize homosexual behavior. There was another case called Roper v. Texas, a decision that banned the death penalty for acts committed under the age of majority. The Supreme Court cited, in overturning the juvenile death penalty, the Supreme Court cited the Convention on the Rights of the Child. This is a treaty that we have never ratified. They also cited the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which bans the death penalty. While it is true the U.S. has ratified that treaty, we have ratified that treaty. But the Senate and the President filed a reservation upon ratification, specifically on the death penalty clause, meaning we accept all of the treaty but that part of it. But that's precisely the part that the Supreme Court cited in overturning Roper, overturning the juvenile death penalty. They cited the part that our government had formally rejected. So can these treaties and directives from UN committees come to harm the U.S.? I say they already have. And more than one Supreme Court justice has said they hope to do more of this in the future. Many of the left-of-center Supreme Court justices regularly go to these conferences in Europe where they talk about specifically these types of things. What we are talking about here is not one world government. Nobody talks about one world government anymore. The high-minded folks at the UN call it global governance, which is the belief that we should be governed by a lattice of agreements and norms that grow out of elite conversations in New York and Brussels and other centers where international civil servants meet. It is also called transnationalism because they believe that governments are inherently troublesome unless they can be harnessed to the progressive agenda. There's a man named Harold Koh. If you're from the Yale Law School, you will know his name. Until a few years ago, he was the dean there. He is now the chief lawyer in the U.S. State Department. He is often on the short list of those considered for the Supreme Court under a Democratic presidency. Koh once wrote that national sovereignty does not exist anymore except insofar as a government ratifies all U.N. treaties and places themselves under the direction of U.N. treaty monitoring bodies. The beauty of our system, rather than the one that Koh and other elites propose, is that in our system, if we do not like the rascals, we can knock on their door and tell them so. If we do not like the rascals, we can vote them out of office. We can run for office ourselves. We can utterly change the political and governmental landscape. In short, we can make the decisions for ourselves. What they propose on the question of abortion and on many other questions is that they get to make the decision. And not in Washington, D.C. either, but in the quiet and carpeted offices at the United Nations and the European Union, locked safely behind doors, far away from messy democracy, far away from the messy likes of you and me. Which brings us to the San Jose Articles. In the fall of 2010, a senior UN ambassador asked my organization to organize a document to be signed by experts in various fields that would refute the claims made by abortion proponents that there exists a right to abortion based on treaty obligations or customary international law. He knows, and I know, that somewhere in the world, on Monday morning, there's a UN bureaucrat or a human rights lawyer telling a policymaker, a lawyer, or a judge that such a right exists. This policymaker, lawyer, or judge is likely unaware of the state of international law on this question. It is arcane, after all. And he will take the word of a UN bureaucrat as gospel. What we envision with the San Jose Articles is that when this person is told there is a new international norm or a new treaty obligation to make abortion legal, that he is able to reach into his desk drawer and say, well, here's a list of 50 international experts who disagree. The purpose of the San Jose Articles is so that this person can instantly push back against this assertion with expert testimony. The articles were drafted by a group of 20 experts who convened over 2 days in San Jose, Costa Rica in March of last year. The articles were subsequently signed by an additional 20 experts. The experts are lawyers, judges, public health experts, and many others. So let me read, hold on 1 second, the San Jose Articles. They're short. Article number 1. You know, I had my eyes lasered a couple of years ago, so I wouldn't have to wear glasses. But after you have your eyes lasered, you still have to have reading glasses. When I wore glasses all the time, I only ever had one pair of glasses for years. And now I have to buy a new pair of reading glasses about every month because I lose them. But aren't these some swinging reading glasses? They're called iBuds, and they're $75. They're more than Walmart, but I find that when I pay a lot, with cheap ones, I tend to, you know, throw them around, and these I just protect. This is a part of your learning, people. Article 1. As a matter of scientific fact, a new human life begins at conception. That's pretty unremarkable, but I'll tell you what. We negotiated that sentence for 5 hours on the first day. 5 hours. It really freaked me out because we only had 2 days to negotiate the whole document. But then it went better. Article 2. Each human life is a continuum that begins at conception and advances in stages until death. Science gives different names to these stages. By the way, if you're trying to write this down, just write down the website, sanjosearticles.org. One word, sanjosearticles.org. The document comes up, the footnotes. It's in 13, 14 languages. Each human life is a continuum that begins at conception and advances in stages until death. Science gives different names to these stages, including zygote, blastocyst, embryo, fetus, infant, child, adolescent, and adult. This does not change the scientific consensus that at all points of development, each individual is a living member of the human species. Now, you may stumble over a couple of these things. There were big debates over fertilization and conception and things like that. We handled all of those types of debates in 6 pages of densely worded footnotes. And just so you know, this document was drafted initially by Robbie George of Princeton, Carter Sneed of Notre Dame, and a very talented team that we put together and then negotiated line by line by 20 experts. So it's got a great deal of credibility. Article 3. From conception, each unborn child is by nature a human being. Article 4. All human beings, as members of the human family, are entitled to recognition of their inherent dignity and to protection of their inalienable human rights. This is recognized in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and other international instruments. Article 5. There exists no right to abortion under international law, either by way of treaty obligation or under customary international law. No United Nations treaty can accurately be cited as establishing or recognizing a right to abortion. The committee, Article number 6, the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women and other treaty monitoring bodies have directed governments to change their laws on abortion. These bodies have explicitly or implicitly interpreted the treaties to which they are subject as including a right to abortion. Treaty monitoring bodies have no authority, either under the treaties that created them or under general international law, to interpret these treaties in ways that create new state obligations or that alter the substance of the treaties. Accordingly, any such body that interprets a treaty to include a right to abortion acts beyond its authority and contrary to its mandate. Such ultra vires acts do not create any legal obligation for states parties to the treaty, nor should states accept them as contributing to the formation of new customary international law. Article 7. Assertions by international agencies or non-governmental actors that abortion is a human right are false and should be rejected. There is no international legal obligation to protect, to provide access to abortion based on any ground, including but not limited to health, privacy, or sexual autonomy, or non-discrimination. Article 8. Under basic principles of treaty interpretation in international law, consistent with the obligations of good faith and pacta sunt servanda, and in the exercise of their responsibility to defend the lives of their people, states may and should invoke treaty provisions guaranteeing the right to life as encompassing a state responsibility to protect the unborn child from abortion. Article 9. Governments and members of society should ensure that national laws and policies protect the human right to life from conception. They should also reject and condemn pressure to adopt laws that legalize or depenalize abortion. Treaty monitoring bodies, United Nations agencies and officers, regional and national courts, and others should desist from implicit or explicit assertions of a right to abortion based on international law. When such false assertions are made or pressure exerted, member states should demand accountability from the UN system. Providers of development aid should not promote or fund abortions. They should not make aid conditional on a recipient's acceptance of abortion. International maternal and child health care funding and programs should ensure a healthy outcome of pregnancy for both mother and child and should help mothers welcome new life in all circumstances. We, human rights lawyers and advocates, scholars, elected officials, diplomats, and medical and international policy experts, hereby affirm these articles. Now, it was signed by, I'm not going to read you the whole list, but Lord David Alton of the British House of Lords, Carl Anderson, the Supreme Knight of the Knights of Columbus, Giuseppe Benigiano, who's the former head of the International Association of OBGYNs and the former head of the Reproductive Health Program of the World Health Organization, was a signer. Professor William Benchy, noted professor of law at the University of Trinity College Dublin and a member of the Irish Human Rights Commission. Javier Borrego, a former judge of the European Court of Human Rights. Christine Boutin, former cabinet minister under President Sarkozy. Martha DeCasco, deputy foreign minister of Honduras. Senator Tom Coburn. Professor John Finnis of Oxford. Robbie George of Princeton. Professor John Haldane, the president of University of St. Andrews. Ambassador Joseph Rees of the United States, Senator Ronan Mullen of Ireland, Professor Carter Sneed of Notre Dame, Lord Nicholas Windsor, who is a member of the British royal family. The San Jose Articles have been presented at the United Nations, the British House of Lords, the Italian Parliament, the Uruguayan Parliament, the European Parliament. They have been translated into more than a dozen languages. We believe they are now being used all over the world. We expect the articles will be mentioned in UN debates and referenced in UN documents. We hope that documents based in the articles will be passed by parliaments around the world. At the end of the day, the documents represent an important part of the theory of customary international law, and that is the concept of persistent objectors. Customary international law requires universal state practice. Persistent objectors demonstrate that this high bar has not been met. The San Jose Articles are a vitally important defense against the implementation of a universal right to abortion. And I would be delighted to take questions.
Very informative. And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, I have three friends on that list of signers. And, you know, I've said often, from our side, we're like R&D in a business and no marketing department. We've got to get this information out. So the first thing that came to my mind was, how many friends do you have at Fox News? I see that you're a regular contributor there, or at least every now and then you give expert testimony.
Yeah.
Not often.
Is that a question?
Yeah, do you have a friend?
Put that in the form of a question?
I'm going to put that in a form of a question in that, do you have a friend or need one that will get this type of information out on a real regular basis?
Well, one of the problems that we do face always, well, here's the thing. The United Nations is a backwater to Americans. The abortion debate at the United Nations is a backwater of a backwater. Americans are only interested in the United Nations when there's peace and war and scandal. So, you know, and so on this particular question, it is practically impossible to get folks at Fox News interested in this particular thing. It just is. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps the audience can help with that. With the current debate about abortion rising to the front page again, this might be a nice time to remind the American people what the Mexico City policy is about and how we are funding all of this bizarre activity. Okay, questions from the audience. Have you considered using the laws of the Indian tribes, the Navajo dependent sovereigns, for whom human life begins at conception? Their laws predate the U.S. Constitution and must be applied by the U.S. when it touches upon their sovereignty.
Well, you know, I don't think that we have to refer to the laws of any other nation, including the Indian nations, because, I mean, the laws of our own country are pretty darn good as it is. I mean, we are here to defend American sovereignty, and I don't think we have to refer to the sovereignty of any other nation. As an institution, my institution protects the sovereignty of all nations. But, I mean, as Americans, I mean, we've got the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, which is good enough.
Should the U.S. consider leaving the U.N.? Pros and cons?
You know, for many years, the U.S. left UNESCO, and so did the United Kingdom. And guess what happened to UNESCO? They kept doing their business. If the U.S. left the United Nations, the United Nations would still be doing its business. Even if the United Nations left the United States, it would still be doing its business, and it would make it harder for conservatives to interact. A lot of the human rights activity at the United Nations, they've taken to Geneva precisely because pro-lifers have been so effective in New York. The only way that we can stay in the... We do not propose the U.S. leaving the U.N. or the U.S., the U.N. leaving the U.S. because we have to stay and fight.
Okay. All right. What side has the most attorneys and money to litigate and argue their international law case, our pro-life side or the pro-abortion side?
Well, you know, the other side, of course, is better funded than we are. I mean, they own most of the law schools. They have, they have foundations with billions of dollars backing them up. We are absolutely outgunned in every way by the other side. You know, and Jesus made it that way. Doggone it. You know. I hear we're a majority in heaven, but not here. But I do want to give a plug to some great groups that do this kind of work, chief among them the Alliance Defense Fund. I call the Alliance Defense Fund the only $30 million a year pro-life organization that nobody's ever heard of.
Right.
They are a remarkable group based in Arizona and now in Washington, D.C., who bring suits now all over the world. And I think they brought 37 federal suits and won most of them. They're amazing, led by an amazing man named Alan Sears.
Yeah, yes, that's one of my friends on your list, actually.
Yep.
And he's in my space in Washington. I understand that there's no basis in international law for a right to abortion, in quotes. Is there any basis in international law to stop forced abortions, for example, in China?
Well, you know, there is pro-life language in existing international law. You know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is non-binding, it's a resolution, refers to a right to life. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is an implementing document of the Universal Declaration, mentions a right to life, refers to human beings. There's plenty of good, juicy language in there that can be referred to protect unborn children from abortion. So that language actually already exists.
Right, and the final question, the writing is a little difficult. Review treaty content. I think what they're asking is why U.S. does not sign the treaties, perhaps referring to when you mentioned the U.S. and Somalia in the same sentence. Any thought on political implications, citizen action? So I think the question might be even asking, what can we do? What can we in this room do about the information you just gave us?
Well, the U.S. doesn't sign these things. It's a high bar to ratify a treaty in the U.S. Senate. You know, what, 67 votes to ratify a treaty? So it's really quite hard. I mean, I did give a tip of the hat to the Democrats for not doing this, but it's rare that they've even had 67 or enough liberal Republicans who would go with them. Even so, we have not ratified most of these treaties, even though we've come under tremendous pressure, constant pressure. I mean, CEDAW has now been ratified as resolutions in a number of states. I don't know what the status is here in Ohio, but But anyway, why hasn't the U.S. done this? We haven't ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child because we believe that our child laws are the best in the world, and why do we need yours, U.N.? And the same thing with CEDAW. And a lot of these treaties are just vaguely written. I mean, they're just bad law that are then reinterpreted by human rights committees. And so the people in Washington understand this. My advice on what you all can do going forward is I always say, don't come to the United Nations, stay at home and take over the school board. That's what people ought to do. You have to act locally. We've got enough people. If you're called to come to the UN, I'll show you what to do. You can come and help us. But for the most part, you have to stay. And, the beautiful part of the beautiful, one of many beautiful things about the United States is we've got 50 laboratories of democracy. And so all of these ideas can be, tried in the states, here in Ohio and in the other states. I'll just close by saying one thing. I would hate to be on the other side of this question. Because the pro-life movement is broad and deep and vast. And every single day, somebody cooks up a really neat idea and then goes and does it. Lila Rose thought of making funny phone calls to Planned Parenthood. Jimmy Nolan thought about getting college students and walking across the country. His name is escaping me on 40 Days for Life, thought up the idea of 40 Days for Life. It is astounding. It's almost like the Middle Ages when the Holy Spirit blew across the land and inspired people to start religious congregations. It's happening now in the pro-life movement. I'm going to give you a bad analogy because this makes us kind of the aggressors of the tigers, but big abortion is like a lumbering elephant lumbering through the jungle set upon by jungle cats. And if you watch any of those jungle movies, those documentaries, one lion will jump on the back and one will grab a leg and one will grab a tail. We are coming at them, big abortion, from every single direction. And the United States and every single day they wake up in the morning understanding that their days are numbered. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Austin Roos, who has headed the Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute, otherwise known as CFAM, since the summer of 1997. He appears on national television networks regularly discussing UN and Catholic issues. Roos has been published in numerous national periodicals and is a columnist for CatholicThings.org, as well as editing CFAM's Friday Facts. Educate yourself on a weekly basis about the important ethical topics of the day by signing up to receive their Friday Facts. For information about CFAM and Mr. Roos, please visit their website at www.c-fam.org. And finally, if you would like to hear this presentation again, you can do so at the click of a button. Please consider supporting our work when you listen to or download this presentation from our website at clevelandrighttolife.org.
If you are encouraged and edified by what you hear, please accept our invitation to become an active and informed member of the pro-life movement. There are many opportunities to serve. Visit our website at www.clevelandrighttolife.org or contact us at 216-661-3000, extension 11, or at lifenews@clevelandrighttolife.org. And please consider sharing this audio file with someone.